This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Since President Obama started talks with the Cuban government to begin to normalize relations, there's been a flood of new educational, tourism, and goodwill trips from the U.S. to the island. Many Americans are getting to see for the first time a country that's been walled off from the global economy and also from the U.S., which is only 90 miles away. Today, Where We Live, the state of Cuban-American relations after President Obama's most recent visit. We'll talk to some Connecticut residents who just returned from the island. Later in the program, we'll hear about the impact of baseball diplomacy, not only at the major league level, but among youth baseball players from Cuba and West Hartford, Connecticut. You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, wnpr.org/where we live. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Joining us in studio is Megan Torrey. She is Executive Director of the World Affairs Council of Connecticut. Megan, welcome back to the show. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, John.
Also with us is Odette Casamayor Cisneros. She is Associate Professor of Latin American, Caribbean, and Latino Literatures and Cultures at the University of Connecticut, and she joins us in studio as well today. Odette, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
We're going to be talking with Megan and other people who've returned recently from the island, but I want to get your perspective first, Odette. President Obama's recent visit to Cuba, in a broad sense, what does it mean for Cuban-American relations?
I would say this is a great moment. It's something that we were hoping, some of us were hoping to happen. It's the only thing I would say about, the first thing I would say about this new engagements between Cuba and the United States is not to consider Cuba as an island frozen in time. So it's a very complex place. And I have the feeling that sometimes some people are saying, well, just the United States is jumping over Cuba. And maybe there are some intents of doing that, but it's not as easy as we will say. It has been an island that it has kept unknown for the United States general public for more than half a century. And it had changed. So even though when we go to Cuba, well, tourists or visitors arrive in Cuba, they have the sense that anything has changed. So you have the old cars, American cars, and the old Art Deco houses and the colonial architecture. Everything is, in a certain way, different as any other places that we had already, that we are used to visit. And what is another important thing concerning this current events between Cuba and the United States is that even though we can have the impression that anything is changing in Cuba because the government is not making radical changes especially in the political arena. This weekend, the Congress of the Communist Party started, and President Raúl Castro made clear that there wouldn't be substantial changes in the government ideology. But the fact is that even though we can imagine that anything is changing, I will say that especially the visit of President Obama is encouraging Cuban people to provoke those changes.
So maybe you could walk us through a few of the changes that we might not know about, the things that have developed on the island of Cuba over time that maybe we wouldn't see if we showed up there. You mentioned American tourists and visitors go and they see the old cars, they see the old architecture, they see in many ways a system that they see as stuck in time, but you've mentioned all sorts of changes in ways in which Cuba is different. What are some of those changes? What are some ways in which Cuba is changing right now?
Well, when I say it's a complex society and something that probably we cannot measure when we arrive for the first time or we stay only for 1 week or for several days, is that the complexity is, well, it's a Latin American country, of course, but at the same time, it has been, you have at least two or three generations of Cubans that had been raised within a socialist system. And the ways in which you, so the combination of both being a Latin American country, a Caribbean country, an isolated country, the sense of isolation too, and at the same time of being raised under a socialist system creates a very specific kind of of population, and you have to deal with that. So sometimes people say that we used to think that those are just those socialist people, and try to compare us with people from the former Soviet Union or other communist former communist countries. But it's not exactly that. And sometimes also they are surprised that Cuban people has a very long relationship and know a lot about American culture, which is also true, but to what extent? So all of that is difficult to understand. But concerning your specific questions, the current changes, I will say that the most importance arose when current President Raul Castro took the power in 2006. And he implemented a series of economic measures that allowed Cubans to invest and to have slowly encourage the small entrepreneurship. But we had also to understand that it's not totally open. So ultimately, all the resources are still in the hands of the state, the communist state. So the Castro's regime.
So it's different than it has been, but it's not so different. And I think that's one of the things we'll get into in today's program as we talk about the state of not just Cuba, but Cuban-American relations today with Odette Casamayor Cisneros from the University of Connecticut. You can join us at 860-275-7266. As I mentioned, Megan Torrey is with us as well from the World Affairs Council of Connecticut. Megan, what took you to Cuba recently?
So I was lucky enough to lead a World Affairs Council trip. So the World Affairs Council around the country runs trips every year, and they've been doing a trip to Cuba for quite some time, since just after the special period. So I was chosen to be a leader of a trip that was going 13 through 21 March this year. So, found out that we would have a little bit 2 days crossover with the president just a few weeks before we left.
And before we get to the actual impact of the president very specifically on your trip, what were some of the things that you were looking for as you entered into this trip? Much like what Odette was just explaining, our view of what Cuba is like is kind of behind this hazy wall. We're not entirely sure what Cuba is like, or how Cubans might feel about Americans, or how much connection there is to the rest of the world or the global economy. What were the preconceptions perhaps you had going in, Megan, and what are some of the things that changed during that visit?
Right. So very good question. So this was a people-to-people diplomacy trip, the purpose of which is to exchange and engage with the Cuban people. And I think as an American, you have sort of this romanticized view, image of what Cuba is. These, wonderful cars, this great island that has been isolated by, the embargo and the political situation over the last 60 years. And what you find, yes, is an island that's been isolated and the infrastructure has suffered all of those years of not having the resources. But you find a very bright, vibrant culture, a culture that's very alive. When you do people-to-people diplomacy, you are encouraged to speak with a lot of artists. And Cuban artists and musicians are some of the best in the world, and they have a passion that I think is definitely contagious. We had interesting briefings by some urban planners and architects, and just the conception of how you can preserve old Havana, that it is very much a living culture, but a living culture that has suffered under some, isolation over the last, 60 years or so.
Were there a few things during your trip that really totally changed in your mind, in which you thought, I thought this about Cuba, and as I come back, I think something entirely, entirely different?
So I think, as Odette said, it's a very complex situation because you see this great architecture and then you see that it's, crumbling, right? So I think as an American and having Cuba so close, it's just very conflicting. I don't think I came to any definitive sort of this is what I thought about Cuba and I'm going back. It's just all very conflicting and challenging because we're at a crossroads now where there is momentum and the potential for change. But in order to reach that change, there's so much that has to be done. So it's quite conflicting, complex, and challenging.
And I think one question that a lot of people have following the president's visit is, is who benefits as these relationships open up, as more Americans and people from around the world come into Cuba, as more business interests are able to invest in Cuba, as you said, as more Cubans are able to be entrepreneurs on the island. These are all changes, but who do these changes benefit, and do they properly benefit the people in Cuba who need help, who literally need to live at a higher level than they are right now?
Well, this is an important question. And first of all, we have to, the first thing is that we don't know what exactly is being negotiated right now. And everything depends on that, on how, in the case of Cuba, how the government, if really the government intends to protect the most impoverished and disempowered part of the population. And probably, Megan, when you were there, you were able to see that there are sharp inequalities in the island. And so far, I will say that not important policies have been developed in order to protect these parts of the population. So it means that so far, given what has been had happened so far through the those negotiations, it's only a sector of those entrepreneurs who are having, who, at least for the Cuban part, who are really having some taking some benefit from the current negotiations, and most of this. So it's somehow what I fear is that the cycle of inequalities might continue to develop, and even that those inequalities will get even worse if something is not.
What do you see as the impact of direct diplomatic efforts by the President of the United States on this? Can the United States, do you feel, Odette, change in any way what is happening in Cuba on the ground? Because we see in some ways our inability to do just that in places like China or Iran or other states that we've had long-standing simmering tensions with. Do you see the president's visit as changing something substantial here?
Substantially, it depends how do you consider substantially. From the government, absolutely not. But at the same, so and from the part of the people, I will say yes. And I think that President Obama, I don't know, but I have the feeling that he was aware of that in his speech. His visit was, and he repeatedly said so, his visit was was a visit for the Cuban people, not for the Cuban government. And the through all his speeches, and especially the last speech, the most important, was particularly dedicated to the Cuban people. He was talking to the Cuban people, and he was trying to encourage within these people to do their own changes. And this is where I would say that, yes, it is, was important. Yes, it had a significant impact for Cubans. But then you have in the other side the government. The government kept the same, at least in their words, they keep the same position. But this is another, element from the complexity, to add to the Cuban complexity. We Cubans, so the Cubans that live in the island and have been raised in the island and have lived there at least for, let's say, 10 or 15 years, they know that everything that the government says is not exactly what would happen. So you have always to read between the lines and to wait what is actually happening in reality and in the other side what the government is saying. So it's really complicated as we were.
Well, and before we take a break, Megan, you know, as somebody who studies foreign policy and diplomacy, certainly, what do you see as the impact of President Obama's visit? Very clearly, this powerful speech he gave was targeted at the Cuban people. There was also an audience back home, some receptive ears back home and some ears that he knew would not be receptive in Congress. But what did you make of the impact of what President Obama did by going and said while he was there?
So I think when we were on the ground in Cuba, just a few days before the visit of the president, talking to Cubans about what their hope is for what the president had to say, they were very much invested and encouraged that this is a new a new page. We're turning a new page. We're able to move. And I think you always have to look at diplomacy, the opening of our embassy, the president's visit. The diplomacy is a tool in your toolbox to reach an end, to open up. I mean, look, we never stopped talking to the Soviet Union during the Cold War, and that this is a significant step towards using that tool of diplomacy to open up relations and to continue building a relationship.
We're talking today with Megan Torrey, who's Executive Director of the World Affairs Council of Connecticut, and Odette Casamayor-Cisneros, who's an Associate Professor of Latin American, Caribbean, and Latino Cultures and Literatures at the University of Connecticut. We'll take some of your phone calls as well at 860-275-7266 as we consider Cuban-American relations here on Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky.
In America, it's still possible for somebody like me, a child who was raised by a single mom, a child of mixed race who did not have a lot of money, to pursue and achieve the highest office in the land. That's what's possible in America.
That's President Obama speaking in Cuba. Today, we're considering the president's visit and what it means for Cuban-American relations. We're going to be talking with people throughout the course of today's program who've been to the island recently. As part of a series of goodwill tours and educational opportunities. We'll even be talking about baseball diplomacy later on in the program. The speech, though, from President Obama prompted our guest, Odette Casamayor-Cisneros, to ask, would a black Cuban ever become president on the island? I'm wondering if you can talk about that. You wrote a beautiful piece about this that we read in Huffington Post and about this very important racial component to the president's visit and what it means for the people on the island as well. What struck you about the president's visit and what he was able to say about that?
Well, surprising for me is that he... It wasn't surprising because I live here, but I suppose sometimes I wonder what would happen if I was there in the audience when he was specifically addressing Cuban Afro-Cubans and also, by the way, Cuban Americans and particularly in Miami, in a Cuban theater, in a public space, and in an event that was broadcast nationally broadcasted. Why it was important is because in Cuba, Afro-Cubans are not used to celebrate and to just to celebrate the agency of black people. And not only a black man, a president of the United States, but a family, a black family. And this is something totally unusual for Cubans. And it wasn't only Afro-Cubans, but the whole population that were celebrating this family. And so there is a problem of black agency, and not even the black agency, because even President Obama in his speech, he acknowledged the agency of Afro-Cubans. It is how in Cuba there is not a recognition of this black agency, and how when, of course, there has been a lot of Afro-Cubans heroes and scientists and professors, scholars, etc. But when their achievements are recognized, it's only as Cubans and not as part of an Afro-Cuban legacy.
And that's so interesting because, again, it's much of the same story that President Obama was fighting against and for in America as he strove to become the first black president of America. And I think for those of us on the outside, viewing this racial component of Cuba is something that probably we don't think about very much and is obviously very important to the story. You have family still on the island, am I correct?
Yes, my mother lived there.
How often do you go back?
A lot.
You go back a lot?
Yes, at least once or twice a year.
What is it like for you going back and forth to Cuba as an American, as a Cuban American now, as an Afro-Cuban? What are those visits like for you? What do you feel when you return to the island?
It's also complicated.
We hear this
because,
word a lot.
Yes, I'm so sorry. I
no,
cannot
it's true.
Give you simple answers. But, it's complicated in the sense that I have been living half of my life. I have spent half of my life out of Cuba. So it's not that hard right now. I was living first for 10 years. I was living in Paris first. And at the beginning, it was harder to go back to Cuba because I was starting to be used to other reality. In this case, it was in Paris. And I remember that at the beginning when I was traveling to Cuba, I had a switch in my mind. I always put it off and on, independence where I was going, because it is not exactly my reality anymore. It's not my society anymore. But at the same time, your body somehow is being carried, but it's memories. And right now, going to Cuba, and especially in these moments in which you feel that some transformations might happen, I feel that I am somehow part of it, but at the same time, given that it's not my reality, it's the Cuban people living in the island who I hope and I believe that they have something to do with all of that. What I try to do in my personal situation is to put all the skills and knowledge that I have from my experiences out of the island and make them useful for them as possible. But at the same time, I always say to my friends and activists that I met in Cuba is that I am there to help, that I am not there to tell them what to do, because I don't know what to do in a situation that is not mine.
What do you make of the very large number of Cuban Americans who live here now who reject the notion that the president should go, who reject the notion that we should break down any sort of trade or other barriers with the island until or unless the Castro regime leaves power?
I will say the same thing that President Obama said in Cuba. We have to go beyond history. It's not that we have to forget history. History is there. We are made of that. But we have to go further. And I respect a lot this Cuban. I respect both parts and all the implied parts and the problems, because there is a lot of pain. And again, President Obama said it in his speech. But he acknowledged that it's something that the Cuban government hadn't do, because it's a really black and white position. So I admire them. I recognize they are suffering, but at the same time, I will say, please think first of your children. What will happen with the future? What we can do with the future? Do we want to stay in the same way with the same pain all the time, or we want to produce something different?
Yeah, and Megan, I'd like to get your thoughts on that too, because obviously, as we talked about, diplomacy and the effects, the impact that it can have on cultural exchange, on economics, and on just politics and people, you believe it to be very powerful, but there are many, many people who would say that the United States engaging with the Castro regime because of what it has done over the years is not where we should be. What do you say to that as someone who's been on the side of, yes, diplomacy is something that we need?
So I think Odette said it best is that really was Obama connecting to the Cuban people and not to the Castro regime. I think once the floodgates open, once you have diplomacy in there and you have American tourists or American visitors going there, 75% increase last year, 75% increase this year, the economics will follow. And once you have that American investment there, I don't think you can stop the train.
Of course, something you were saying to us during the break that's very important that you learned from some of the meetings that you have is, yes, we may have more flights to Cuba from America than we've had ever before. We'll have more boats going and we'll have more hotels being built. The question is, can Cuba's infrastructure, can the whole setup that we have right now actually sustain what they're hoping to get out of this tourism boom?
Right. So I think what you'll see in Cuba now, with so many visitors going, as I just mentioned, since December 2014, the increase in American travel to Cuba has been 75% last year. That's on track to beat that this year. You have a tourist industry in Cuba that is stretched beyond its limits. Any given day, all hotel rooms in Cuba, this is on the entire island, 100% booked. We ran into shortages of bottled water. We ran into shortages of coffee, of all things, in Cuba. The infrastructure is very stretched, and how, as a country, you can respond to that, it's going to take some time to figure out.
And you actually have a personal experience with that, because you had a crossover time with President Obama's visit. You actually were personally affected by what happens when the president brings his entourage.
Absolutely. So as the entourage grew to, I think, over 1,200 people that went with the president to Cuba, about 2 days before we left, we found out that, you can't stay in Havana. We're sending you out to Varadero, which is no one goes to Varadero, right? So Americans aren't technically allowed to go there. So we were sort of kicked out of our hotel. And I know that part of it was by the Tampa Bay Rays. So.
The Tampa Bay Rays,
Tampa
of course.
Bay Rays.
And this is because the baseball team is coming to play this exhibition game, which we'll be talking about in a little bit. But that was a piece of it, right? You get a whole bunch of activity around this, and now the Americans who are there on a sort of a diplomatic mission aren't able to do what they're doing.
Right. There wasn't, not enough room. We'll send you away. So, tourism is stretched very, very thin in Cuba.
Well, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to be talking a bit more about this notion of baseball diplomacy. It's not just major leaguers, the Tampa Bay Rays, who are showing up to play an exhibition game against the Cuban national team. But it's also little leaguers from places like West Hartford and Vermont that show up. And they spend time on the island learning about Cuba. We'll be talking hopefully with Bill the Spaceman Lee, a great Boston Red Sox pitcher who's been back and forth there a number of times. We'll take some of your phone calls as well. Right now, I'm going to turn you over to some of our friends who are going to tell you why you should support WNPR and all the programming that we bring you, all the voices from around the world. This is Where We Live.
1-800-584-2788 is the number to call. Hi there, I'm Lydia Brown, and I'm here with my colleague Betsy Kaplan, and we're in the last week of our spring fundraising campaign, which is why we're taking just a few minutes out of Where We Live to ask you to consider supporting WNPR. You know, because you listen to this station, we know you're a person who's curious about the world and interested in learning new things. I know I've certainly been learning a lot these past few minutes listening to Where We Live talk about Cuba and Cuban-American relations. And where else are you going to hear a conversation like that? I mean, the short answer is nowhere. Programs like Where We Live, The Colin McEnroe Show, The Faith Middleton Food Schmooze are completely unique to this station, to WNPR. You're not going to hear anything like them anywhere else. So if you're one of the many listeners who's come to love and rely on these shows over the years, consider giving us a call now and showing your support. 1-800-584-2788. That's 1-800-584-2788. Or you can go online to WNPR.org.
Thanks, Lydia. I agree. If you're listening to Where We Live right now, that means you love this show. You love the fact that you can hear topics that range from gardening to Cuba, and you hear it from lots of different perspectives. And in this climate, this political climate right now, where you're hearing mostly yelling and screaming on other commercial radio stations and the television stations as well, it's kind of a welcome change. So if you value that, please give us a call. I will say that thanks to a generous donation, or a generous longtime donor and supporter of Where We Live, if we can raise $1,000 this hour by 10 o'clock, we'll get an additional $1,000 immediately to support Where We Live. So if you love Where We Live, they're going to get some extra money if you can help us out this morning. But we have to raise that $1,000 this hour to get that additional money. Some people have been calling in, and we want to thank a few people. Margaret Smith called in. She said she took the Mother's Day bouquet and left in capital letters, "Please leave outside the garage door if no one is home." We got a couple of renewing members calling in, someone who just moved to Connecticut in September and is already hooked on WNPR. Pierre Barber called from Unionville, Connecticut, to say, "I love your programming. It's something I look forward to." Another donor says she needs WNPR every day in her life. This sounds like people who love what we do. If you're one of those, please give us a call, 1-800-584-2788, or if easier, please go online, WNPR.org.
Again, that's 1-800-584-2788. And of course, we have lots of great ways to say thank you when you give. For instance, Mother's Day is just around the corner, and maybe you've been trying to figure out what to get for that special mom or mom figure in your life. Well, we've got the answer right here with our Mother's Day bouquet. It's a beautiful pink and green arrangement that comes with a square vase and chocolates. It can be yours for a gift of $10 a month or a one-time gift of $120, and it can can be delivered anywhere in the United States, in the lower 48 states, I should say, by Friday, May 6th. Again, that would be for $10 a month. Now, if you'd rather that be delivered by Saturday, May 7th, all that takes is a monthly contribution of $11, just a dollar more each month, or a one-time gift of $132. So if that sounds like something mom might like, give us a call, 1-800-584-2788, or go online to WNPR.org. And just remember, you know, no amount is too small. The simple fact that you give shows us, you know, how much you appreciate WNPR and all of the great information it provides you. 1-800-584-2788 or WNPR.org.
I do want to emphasize that no donation is too small. I agree with Lydia. Mm. But you need to make that donation. You've probably heard a lot of people on this station mention, or while we're fundraising, say that only about 1 in 10 of our listeners actually give us money. That's really not enough. The money that you give to us supports all the programming that you hear, including the locally produced shows that happen on this from this Hartford studio and New Haven studio. There's Faith Middleton Food Schmooze, Where We Live, which is what you're listening to now, and the Colin McEnroe Show. They aren't made for free. It takes a lot of money to bring you the local news that you hear in the afternoon by reporters who go in depth in education, culture, business, Capital Report. So those things are valuable to you. They're valuable to us. Please give us a call. If you don't want the Mother's Day flowers, you can go online at WNPR.org. There's plenty of gifts there. We're giving away tickets to see Ira Glass at the Bushnell on November 12th. That's presented by our friends at the Mark Twain House. Again, 1-800-584-2788. 1-800-584-2788. Thank you.
Yes, 1-800-584-2788 is the number to call. Show us your support. Get on board. 1-800-584-2788. And thank you.
This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, we'll look back at the six pillars of Hartford. Remember those? They were revitalization projects back in the 1990s. Things like housing, parking, the big sports megaplex. Some of these have been completed. Some of them, of course, haven't. What does this do for the city, and where's it left the city after all these years? We're going to take a look back at the six pillars of Hartford, find out where we are right now. That's coming up on tomorrow's Where We Live. Today, we're talking about President Obama's recent trip to Cuba, and we're talking to Connecticut residents who recently returned from the country, including a group of baseball diplomats from West Hartford. I want to remind you that our guests in studio are Megan Torrey from the World Affairs Council of Connecticut and Odette Casamayor-Cisneros, who is from the University of Connecticut. Joining us now by phone are Jack and Tim Brennan. Jack is a Sedgwick Middle School eighth grader. He's a baseball diplomat, and he's a shortstop and a pitcher. Jack, welcome to Where We Live.
Thank you.
Also with us is Tim Brennan. That's Jack's dad. He runs Teen Cultures Connect, who was also part of this Cuba trip, helped to put this thing together. Tim, thanks so much for being here.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
Hey, Tim, first of all, tell us, where was the genesis for this idea? Where did this come from?
The idea actually came from Bill Spaceman Lee, a Hall of Famer for the Boston Red Sox, who told us about this program that had been running out of Canada. And I said, this is amazing. We need to do this out of the U.S. and be the first USA Cuba Goodwill program.
Bill Lee is also with us on the line as well. The spaceman, of course, a longtime pitcher for the Red Sox and the Montreal Expos. He went to Cuba as part of this project. You can also see more about his Cuba visits as part of Spaceman, a Baseball Odyssey. Bill Lee, welcome to the show.
Well, good morning, boys. You're all recovered, and you sound very enthusiastic. This is good.
Bill, tell us about what your connection has been to Cuba over the years and why you think it's important to bring young baseball players like Jack Brennan to the island.
I played with Louis Tiant for 10 years, and he's from Havana, and we were best friends. We were both married to a woman named Maria, and we both had two boys and a girl in the exact same year. We're joined at the hip forever. You know, and they're great people, and I got to go down in 99. I've been down 14 times. You know, the only problem I've had is getting back into the United States, and I was stuck for 15 minutes because the border guard yesterday afternoon was a Yankee fan.
which that's something that's going to be a problem for you and maybe not for some others, Bill.
Yeah, you can always tell a Yankee fan, you just can't tell him much.
Hey, I want to turn to Jack Brennan, who's here. So Jack, you got a chance to go with this famous baseball player and all your friends and your dad down to Cuba. What were you thinking about as you were going there, and what did you learn while you were there?
Well, we learned that
We have a lot more than they have, and we're just very lucky, and we take a lot of things for granted that they don't really get down there.
Mm. Do you think there's something specific, Jack, about baseball that helps to bring people together so that they can talk across cultures, maybe when, you know, you don't have anything else in common, at least you have baseball in common?
Yeah, I think baseball is a common language between USA and Cuba, and it helps us bring us together as two countries and unite us.
Hey, Tim, tell us about the actual games and stuff. I mean, did you play games against Cuban players? How did that all go?
Listen, it went really well, other than the fact that we were 0-3 in Tuckahoe, as Bill Lee pointed out. But baseball was secondary for us. The main point, as you said, was to connect the kids. And even though they didn't all speak the same language, they spoke baseball. We had them actually at our hotel. They ate together, swam together, played wiffle ball together, and they are now connected, and we're bringing them back here to Connecticut this July. So we're going to complete that connection, if you will, like a circuit.
Bill, maybe you can tell us a bit more about your experience over the years with, you know, you say Louis Tiant, the great former Red Sox pitcher, was your best friend. It's one of the reasons why you had a connection to Cuba. We've heard the stories of everyone from Louis Tiant all the way to Yasiel Puig today who've been able to make this trip. Do you think that baseball has a special place in connecting these two cultures?
Most definitely. It's a timeless game, and it connects us in a way that's goes on forever, and they have very few tractors. They have oxen down the sides of the street. There is no noise. There's no weed whackers. They do everything by hand. They're all craftsmen. They're all multi-dimensional. They're what I call they're generalist. They're not specialist. They all have to do everything. They all pull together. They're all educated. They all speak English to an extent. And they are all, their medical is free. We had one of our boys, Krabby, go down, and they took care of him perfectly, got him back, rehydrated him, got him back on the field, and he was our top pitcher. He retired 9 straight batters in a row, you know, and I think we would have won that game if we had had him healthy sooner. But these boys, they were so, our American boys were so great in that they appreciated and were with open eyes and saw that it's better to give than to receive. It's better to open your hand than to close your hand. And I believe that's the message that we brought, and that's the message we're going to bring back. And all these soothsayers and people that are from Miami and everything else, these were the upper 1% that left after the revolution because they were Batistaites. And if you can read the story of Batista, Fulgio Batista, and the mobs and all the people down there, just watch, you know, Godfather 1 and 2, and you will know who the right guys are.
Bill, before I let you go, I just have to ask you, you say you've gone 14 times. What have you seen change over the years? Have you seen an enormous amount of change since you first made your first visit to Havana?
Not a thing. Very little. They had paved an extra lane in Holguin. That's all I noticed. I think that was for the Pope.
Bill, the Spaceman Lee, former Major League Baseball pitcher, he put together this idea of taking young baseball players to Cuba. He's been there a number of times. You can see more about his voyage as a spaceman, a baseball odyssey. Bill, so great to talk to you. Thanks for being here on Where We Live. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you, Tim and Jack. I know you loved it, and I will see you soon and bring those Cubans down. And I still want to open that pizza parlor halfway between Holkin and our hotel because we need good Connecticut, New Haven pizza somewhere on the earth. Bye.
So after baseball diplomacy, pizza diplomacy. Thank you so much, Bill. And Tim, you say that there's the next voyage is actually something that brings the two places together once again, but actually up here in Connecticut.
This July, it's going to be great. We have a group of 20 coming down, including 12 baseball players and coaches. We're going to have them here in the greater Hartford area. We're talking to the Yard Goats about playing there. You know, Bill Lee will be here. Louis Tiant is invited. Just wait. We do need some help, though. We're fundraising for every bit of it. We're paying for their passports, visas, flights, food, transportation, everything. So stay in touch, watch the media, watch our Facebook. Everyone can be a part of this.
Tim Brennan from Teen Cultures Connect. And Jack Brennan, you looking forward to continuing this baseball diplomacy?
Yeah, it's going to be really fun with the Cuban players and kids and just making friends with them and making connections.
Tim and Jack, thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Today on Where We Live, we're talking about Cuba and U.S. connections. Odette Casamayor Cisneros is an associate professor of Latin American, Caribbean, and Latino cultures and literatures at the University of Connecticut. What do you make of this baseball diplomacy here? It's one of those things that has been happening over the years in which, you know, sports can sometimes bring people together in a way that other things can't. We were talking off the air about how music is another one of those things. Talk about these connections made by programs like this. What as a Cuban American, what do you think of this?
I think I welcome all those initiatives, even in culture or in the sports. Well, in this case, it's baseball. My son, unfortunately, what he plays is soccer, so there's no, I cannot say a lot about that. But I think it's a good way, a smart way to develop those relationships because at the participants in this baseball game from the West Hartford in Cuba, they have said, well, it's a way in which the real people-to-people exchange there, and especially between kids, because they are able, as I was saying before, we have to think of the future. Those are our kids here in the States or in Cuba, and they are having this experience that was impossible to think about for me, for instance, when I was in Cuba, how to play or to have any direct exchange with Americans. And for them, it's a reality.
Well, and that direct exchange, and that's really, Megan, what your visit is about and what so many of these visits are about. You talked about the people-to-people diplomacy. Is that what really makes the difference, the idea of going someplace, talking to people who live different lives than you, maybe learning a little bit something about the culture and probably learning quite a bit about your own as well. I think Jack Brennan, a young pitcher and shortstop, said, you know, look, they don't have what we have. I think it's fair to say that for an awful lot of kids growing up in West Hartford, Connecticut, they don't have a great depth of experience on how people unlike them live. And I think getting to go to Cuba probably gives them a pretty good idea about that.
I think it's an eye-opening experience. I think it exposes our common humanity and how we can all move together as part of as global citizens. And I think for these young people in West Hartford, it is a life-changing, impactful experience to realize that, you know, I have so much, but yet all of these, you know, these kids in Cuba just want what we want. You know, it's common humanity, and it's growing the relationship and building a future together.
We have a call from Ray in Wallingford, who's got to comment a bit on the history that Bill the Spaceman Lee was talking about. Hey, Ray, you're on Where We Live. Go ahead.
Hi, how you doing?
Doing well. What's on your mind?
Yes, yeah, so I was just calling in reference to the comment about the one percenters who left Cuba. And I was sort of taken aback by that comment just because it couldn't be farther from the truth. And now we have a situation where I'm Cuban-American. My family is Cuban immigrants, and they were school teachers. They worked for the government. And the reason why they left was because my grandmother came to school one day, and all the books were being burned. So it's not a question of that their money was taken away, which everything was. But they left because their basic fundamental human rights were taken away. And since Castro has been in power, none of that has come back. So I appreciate that what the diplomacy and what we're trying to do here, but I think people are forgetting that this is still a communist regime where human rights, basic fundamental human rights, are taken away. People cannot have a glass of milk past the age of 8. You cannot go to the grocery store and buy food. Yes, is there good health care? Great. Are they great baseball players? Yes. But so much other, culturally, artistically, is taken away because it's a communist regime.
What do you think? Well, Ray, I first of all, I very much appreciate your voice in this conversation. I think it's important. I'm wondering if you can talk, though, about what you think the impact is of, say, President Obama going or the Tampa Bay Rays going, and whether or not this actually changes anything, or whether or not it sends, in your mind, the wrong message to a Castro government that hasn't really changed very much over the years in the way it treats people. Do you think that we're sending the wrong message through some of the efforts that we've been making?
I do. Simply because the Castros wouldn't be doing this unless it benefited them. They're doing this to bring money that they could put back in their pocket. The Castros have been in power for a majority of the years. They know what they're doing. They're bringing Obama and this type of organization, all these, you know, the tractors, all this money in, the cruise lines, so they can get money. They bring the cruise lines could go to Cuba, but Cubans can't go on it.
Mm. Ray, thank you very much for your phone call, and I really appreciate your voice in this. Odette, I'd love for you to respond to a little bit of what Ray said, because, well, we've said it many times during this conversation. This is very complex, and I think he's pointing at some of those complexities right now.
I agree with Ray, what he's saying. But at the same time, we are so focused always to think only about what the government is doing. And I agree what he is saying, of course, is financially helping, because I have said it in the beginning, who are the owners, maybe in our previous conversation, who are the real owners of all the infrastructure and all those hotels and restaurants and everything in Cuba is the state. And this, of course, is the Castro regime. And from what I have heard this weekend, President Raul Castro said in the Communist Party, the Congress of the Communist Party, it intends to continue that way. He said at a certain moment, if there were two parties in Cuba, one would be led by Fidel Castro and the other one by myself.
I will say, as we run low on time.
I want to say is that we also have to think about the people and what the people themselves can do with this visit and how, if possible, they can make some changes on their own. I don't know if it is possible, but I want to think that people can do that.
I want to thank Odette Casamayor Cisneros from the University of Connecticut. Thank you so much for your expertise. Thanks to Megan Torrey from the World Affairs Council of Connecticut. And thanks to our executive producer, Katie Talarski, for producing today's program. We're going to turn you over to some of our guests who now can tell you how you can support WNPR and everything we bring you here. This is Where We Live.
Hi, everybody. I'm Betsy Kaplan. I'm here in the studio this morning with Lydia Brown, asking you to take a few minutes to support this station if you like what you just heard. We just heard a great in-depth conversation on Where We Live on Cuba and Cuba's relations with the United States after President Obama's recent visit. It's the first day of our second week of fundraising, and I want to just emphasize really quickly that what you just heard was a full hour-length show, in-depth, different viewpoints, no commercials. I can't emphasize enough how important it is that we don't have commercials on this station. When you have to put together a show or a story, you have to report in short breaks. You can't dive deeply into a story. And not only do commercials break the mood and interrupt the narrative, but stations are beholden to commercial interests. This station belongs to you. It's for you. It's often by you. We take your ideas. You pitch ideas, and we turn those into shows. You call in and ask questions of guests, and often we have Hartford residents on or local residents on as guests. So if that's important to you, please give us a call at 1-800-584-2788 or donate online at WNPR.org.
Yeah, that's right, Betsy. And also, I just want to mention that thanks to a very generous longtime donor and supporter of Where We Live, we have a special challenge going on this hour. And that is, you know, if we can raise $1,000 this hour, we will get an additional $1,000 immediately to support Where We Live. But we have to raise that $1,000 in order to unlock this additional money. So I know a lot of people wait for challenges to pledge their support. Well, now is your chance. 1-800-584-2788 or WNPR.org. Betsy?
Yeah. So you can get lots of great gifts. And I know that maybe getting a gift isn't the purpose of you giving money, but getting a gift is sort of a nice little byproduct of giving. So what you can get is the Mother's Day flowers, which I know Lydia mentioned in the past break, two delivery dates. If you'd like them on Friday, May 6th, you can get those for a donation of $10 a month. If you prefer closer to the day, Saturday, May 7th, you can get those for $11 a month. If flowers aren't your thing, maybe you want tickets to see Ira Glass at the Bushnell on November 12th. That's presented by our friends here at Mark Twain, right down the street from us in Museum, for $90. There's lots of things that you can get. I can go through lists and lists and lists. There's hundreds of things in our book. If you would like to look, get online at WNPR.org, and you'll see all sorts of things. I actually got a CD for Motown, believe it or not too long ago. I'm probably the only person that got it, but I enjoyed it. So Again, please give us a call. We really, really need your support. I can't emphasize that enough. 1-800-584-2788 or WNPR.org.
1-800-584-2788 is the number to call. A lot of people calling in this morning, getting us closer to that $1,000 goal that we have. The hour is coming to a close, so 1-800-584-2788.